Post-Dispatch reporters Ali Zechariah and Mike Wagner spent months profiling one of the city's most notorious streets. Sullivan Avenue marks the epicenter of two neighborhoods plagued by rampant prostitution, drugs, and crime. In their three-part series, the two chronicle the stories of the women who sell their bodies, law enforcement officials tasked with keeping the peace, and what it's like for everyone else who lives along Sullivan. These are stories from Sullivan Avenue.
It all started last year when a Columbus police vice officer shot and killed a woman during what he said was an undercover prostitution sting a block off of Sullivan Avenue. And what that did was kick-started a series of events that blew up the vice unit for Columbus Police. But more importantly, what happens on Sullivan Avenue and the societal ills that plague that street and those neighborhoods. Until that point, everyone else was able to look away. They could ignore what life was like on Sullivan Avenue. And when Vice Officer Andrew Mitchell shot and killed Donna Dalton Castleberry, nobody could look away anymore. So we begin to ask, how can a neighborhood get so bad that even the cops are dirty and nobody cares? And so we talked about what can we do about this and how can we take a look at what life is like on Sullivan Avenue. So we picked a 3-mile stretch. We went from downtown, the freeway and Dodge Rec Center, to Hague Avenue. And we essentially, Mike and I, embedded out there and decided we needed to expose what goes on out there to see if maybe we can fix it. There's a rich history. Sullivan Avenue was one of the first streets laid out in what would become Columbus, but it's a victim of its own geography. It was consistently swamped by the Scioto River, and the Great Flood of 1913 ravaged the Franklinton area, and it never really recovered. The housing stock never really recovered from that. And so what happened is it was an economically depressed area, largely because of the flooding. And it became known, people really dislike the moniker, but it became known around Ohio as the Bottoms. Franklinton was called the Bottoms. And it was called that because it's at the bottom of the hill. So the hilltop, part of Sullivan Avenue is in the hilltop neighborhood, and part of Sullivan Avenue is in Franklinton, which folks used to call the Bottoms. Sullivan Avenue corridor has this rich history, but it's been forgotten as people left the area and businesses closed and homes became vacant. The only thing left in so much of it is crime.
I had never really been on Sullivan Avenue in any dedicated way before. And so the first day that I went out, and it was day and night, I wanted to sort of get a full picture of what life was like at all hours of the day. So we started mid-morning, and I was astonished at the number of prostitutes that I saw walking up and down the street, astonished at the number of cars. I think it was a Wednesday morning, but the number of cars that were stopping. There was a hub, a carryout right off of Sullivan that seemed to be the central focus of where Johns would pull up, and the women would nod at them, and then they would approach the car. And I watched this cycle for a couple of hours where the cars would disappear. They usually pulled around into alleys that were trash-filled, broken glass, weeds everywhere. Many of the houses up and down Sullivan are vacant or boarded up. Some are drug houses, but these cars would then reappear sometimes a half an hour later. And it was a cycle that repeated itself. And as someone who lives in the suburbs, I just couldn't believe that this was something. Holly and I have both been reporters for a long time, but we've both been personally affected by what we saw out there. And I can't believe that this is a neighborhood that exists in a community that is such a thriving one like Columbus is. And so as the day wore on, you saw many of the women who are addicted to crack and heroin, who are out there without food and water. Many of them approached our vehicles asking for a candy bar, for a pop, water. Hey, can you give me $5 so I can get McDonald's? I was solicited many times myself, even on the first day. We watched the drugs being exchanged. I remember parking right across from the carryout at one stretch watching all this, and these men pulled up behind me and approached my car, and they said, they were polite, but they said, "Sir, you can't park here." It was a public street. And I said, "Okay." And I pulled around two blocks away, and then I watched, and sure enough, that was their spot where they were selling drugs to people. I've been asked a lot by colleagues, friends, and families if I was ever in harm's way, if I was ever in danger, or I felt scared out there. And going into it, because of the reputation and the area, and we'd actually had agreed that we were going to try to go out in pairs just to protect one another. The simple answer is no. I was never scared. I was never threatened by anyone. I was never really in harm's way. I tried to be smart, but because anyone we approached was shocked and overwhelmed and welcoming of the attention. Even when they found out we were from the newspaper, they were puzzled. They didn't quite understand, but it to them, somebody actually was caring enough to try to find out what their life was like. We watched the mistreatment of several women by men who were grabbing them by the arm, pulling them around the corner. We learned in talking to several of the women, even that day, and we tried to be very careful to not approach women who might be controlled by a man, or for lack of a better word, a pimp, but not put them in harm's way, because many of them have quotas. They're told to go out on the street and earn as much as they can in dealing with Johns and servicing them with sex acts for as cheap as $20. If they don't come back with their quota, they don't get the drugs that they desire, or in some cases they can be beaten or kicked out and have no place to stay, and so on. I went back at night, saw a very similar pattern. The amazing thing is that we saw the patrol officers from Columbus Police going up and down the street. And this was my first day, so I didn't understand myself. And I kept saying, why in the world are they just watching this? How can they just drive by and see the needles on the ground and clearly see all the things that I've seen just in one day? We explain why. Maybe Holly can elaborate on that a little bit.
So I spent a good deal of time with Sergeant Fred Brophy, who runs the summer initiative along Sullivan and in that part of town. And the police are, I really walked away with, they're as frustrated as everyone else. You know, just a little bit of context, I think, here. People hear how bad it is, and if you've not spent any time down there, it's easy to say, well, there are other pockets of the city that are like that too. And that's just not true. We looked at the numbers. Every metric that is used to gauge what life is like, Sullivan Avenue is failing. And there were more than 1,800 prostitution arrests we pulled from 2017 through summer of this year. More than half of them took place on that stretch of Sullivan Avenue or just a few steps off. There's more Narcan used there than in any other part of the city. Narcan is the antidote to an opioid overdose. So if you're overdosing on heroin and you're dying, Narcan is administered to bring you back to life and restore your breathing. That part of the city has more administered than any part of the city, and one of the highest rates in Ohio. So with that as a backdrop, the misery out there is a combination of drugs, prostitution, homelessness, and poverty. And the police can't solve that. So the number one thing they hear from people who live there, and there are lots of good people who live there, and they've stayed because they love their neighborhood. We talk to them in the story why they stay. And the police want to fix the problem. But let's just take prostitution as an example. That's their number one complaint. People who live there say, do something about these women who walk the streets. Well, there's two things about that. One, people think that a cop sees a woman, as Mike said, nod at a car or get into a car, well, arrest her. It's not illegal to walk up to a car. It's not illegal to get in a car. It's not illegal to have sex in a car. So unless the officer sees the transaction, sees the money change hands, or hears an offer being made, they can't do anything. They can get loitering. They can slap loitering charges on them in some instances, but that's not, first of all, none of the businesses down there want to run any of these folks off. Nobody's complaining that these women are loitering. So the police are just as frustrated at trying to, what can we do? And they're struggling for an answer. On the flip side of that, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the women, because I think I feel very strongly about human trafficking and thought I knew so much. I've been reporting for 30 years. I started when I was 5. I've been reporting for 30 years, and I've covered every drug epidemic there is. I've covered homelessness. Mental health is a huge, important issue to me. And I thought I knew as much as I could about all of those things. And then I got to Sullivan Avenue, and I saw the intersection of all of those things. The homelessness, the addiction, the poverty, and the misery. And I just couldn't believe how we got here. The depths of despair for the people who walk up and down that street and who sleep in the bushes and who hide in abandoned garages in hopes that somebody won't steal their bag that carries their toothbrush. It just kept me up every night. I left thinking, we have to do better. And there has to be a way, because nobody, to a person that I talked to on the streets out there who live on the street and walk those streets, had any hope. None of them. No hope that they could ever get out. And there are so many people down there who are trying. There are great advocates in the neighborhood, great programs. They think they're not worth it. They think they're not worth the effort. No one's ever loved them. You know, the statistics bear it out that victims of human trafficking, prostitutes, are, again, to a person, almost, were sexually abused as a child. They don't know any different. They've never known anything else in their life other than that people beat them and rape them and take what they want from them. And so some woman comes along and says, I can help you. Why should that woman on Sullivan Avenue trust them? Nobody's ever helped her before. And the despair was just crippling. And Mike's right. It changed me. And I was not a stranger to Sullivan Avenue. My family lives on the west side. I didn't grow up down here, but I had 12 cousins who live on the west side. And grew up on Larkham and Mound and Sullivan. Still live on Richardson, Burgess. So I knew, I thought I knew, but I didn't.
It made me angry. Holly captured it perfectly. In one word, it's hopelessness. And the sad reality is that these people have accepted their existence. They are defeated. They think that this is what their life is going to be. Maybe two or three people said that, you know, maybe someday things will get better, but 95% of the folks just accept that this is where they're going to live, and the drugs, the prostitution, the crime, the homelessness, all of those things are just going to be a part of their life. I witnessed exactly what Holly just explained, with some of them just rejecting help because they don't believe that they're worthy of help or that somebody's serious about helping them. And so we were out on Sullivan with an advocate who lost her daughter to this. And she, I'm in her back seat, kind of cramped, small car. And there's probably a dozen to 15 bags with random things, toothbrushes and t-shirts and cans of pop and bottles of water and so on, and some other health products. And we drove around, would pull up, and she would flag down one of the women. A lot of them would come over, and they kind of knew who she was, and they would take the bag, say thank you, and walk away. But there was this one young woman in particular, couldn't have been any more than 18, 19 years old, if that. Could have even been a minor. And we pull up, and she says, "Go away. Get out of here." So the advocate drove around the block, and she makes another attempt. You know, tells her, "I'm an advocate. I'm out here trying to help you. Just at least take this bag." And she says, "I told you, get the hell out of here," and just to start screaming at the top of her lungs. And the advocate, you know, then gets pretty aggressive, and she called it tough love and said, "No, I'm trying to help you." And they start cussing at one another, and they're yelling at each other up and down the block. I'm in this back seat, and I'm like, my goodness, what world am I in down here? And I think a lot of us, not that I haven't done reporting around the city and other neighborhoods before, but I think a lot of us live in our bubbles and just have never seen or experienced or can believe that people can live like this day after day after day. And again, this is happening in broad daylight. It was shocking to us that this happened at 8 o'clock in the morning, noon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, broad daylight. This was not the cliche of a movie that this kind of behavior only went on at night. To finish the story about the young woman who was yelling at the advocate, I guess the next day she encountered the advocate's friend again, and she wanted to apologize. She didn't mean to be angry, but she's lost there. She had only been on the streets for a few months. Some of these women have been out there for decades. Decades. You know, Holly and I both are reporters because we like to try to make a difference in someone's life. It made me feel like kind of a failure, to be honest, to see all this, because it's like we all need to do a better job in trying to get help for these people. I remember very vividly my 9-year-old's first day at elementary school just inside Delaware County, and it was a beautiful day, and my wife and I walked into school, and everyone's taking cell phone pictures, and there's the green grass, and we're kicking a soccer ball, and you know, it's how a lot of us spend the first day of school with our kids. So on the first day of school for an elementary school that's located right off Sullivan, I got there at like 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and we wanted to see what the first day of school was like on Sullivan. And there were somewhere between 4 and 5 prostitutes already walking up and down the street right in front of a school as the buses pulled up. And I started walking around the school, and I see this this man leaning up against the car, and he's watching his daughter with two of his grandkids. And I had noticed this black car that had circled around the school 3 or 4 times, as did he. So I went up and talked to him, and I said, I'm a reporter with the dispatch. Why are you standing out here, and what are you doing? And he says, "Well, I'm standing guard." He used those words. "I'm standing guard over my daughter and my grandkids. I see this, see that car over there? You know, he's looking for drug customers. That's a drug car." You know, he could see the prostitutes as well. Holly referenced earlier how the part of that neighborhood got its name, the Bottoms. Well, a lot of these folks call it the Bottoms, but they're not referring to a flood area. They're referring to, this is the bottom of life. And he said, you know, this is life in the bottoms. And it just, as a father, as a human being, it just devastated me to hear that this was his granddaughter's first day of school. And down Sullivan a little ways, there's a middle school about a half mile away on Central Avenue. So a few boys were walking down the street. Some of these things we didn't put in the story, but a couple of the women approached two or three boys that had their backpacks. I didn't want to approach the boys. I'm making, and this is why we didn't put in them a story. We try to collaborate or confirm what we learn. But I got to assume they were at least feeling out these boys and seeing if they had money on them or whatever. But I just can't imagine my middle school age son interacting with prostitutes on the way to school.
So drop-in centers are places, safe spaces, that are run by volunteers. There are two on Sullivan proper where the women can go. They're open generally just a couple of hours a week. The women can come in and get a change of clothes because, again, they don't have anything. Everything gets stolen from them. They have the clothes that they're wearing. Many of the women have a cloth bag or a backpack that they carry that might have, let's be honest, it's going to have their dope in there and maybe a toothbrush, the cans of Coke that an advocate gives them or something. So they can come in, they can get a fresh change of clothes. I saw women just strip their clothes off that they had on right there, throw them out and put new clothes on. They can get a hot meal. They can wash up in the bathroom. They can talk to advocates if they want. There are safe spaces, there are quiet spaces, couches where they can just get a nap for an hour without worrying about somebody coming along and hurting them. I felt very privileged to be asked in because, again, it is a safe space. They don't want strangers coming in. So I was invited to spend an evening at one of the drop-in centers run by a local advocate, Esther Flores, who is such a gift to that part of town for the love that she showers on these women. And I went in, and I didn't know what to expect, but what I saw wasn't what I thought I'd see. It was perhaps the most overwhelming assignment I've ever had. Just for the energy that is in the drop-in center is such a complex mix of things. So these women, it opens at 6, and the women just, boom, 40 women coming in the door because they're looking, they look forward to that couple of hours of safe space. So they come in, they get their clothes, not a lot of chit-chat. It kind of ebbs and flows. Some of them are just there to get their stuff and leave. Some of them will catch up. They come with babies in strollers. There were 3 kids there that night that came in with their mothers when I was there. It's all run by volunteers. And they come in, they sign in just so they can keep track. They all sign in by their street names. There's no questions asked. We've talked so much about the misery, but the love that goes on inside that drop-in center is an unbelievable thing. These volunteers hug the women when they come in, ask them, they remembered, like, hey, you had a sore throat when you were in here last week. Is it better? And you can just see it's like the weight of the world has just dropped off of their bodies. Can you imagine the lifestyle that you live where somebody asking you and genuinely wants to know if you still have a sore throat can bring you to tears? That somebody cares about you enough to say, hey, is your throat okay? Because that's what happens at the drop-in center. And if I can share just a couple things that I saw that really affected me. One is we talk about in the story, but I'll tell you a little bit more about it if I can. A woman came in that had never been there before. And she'd just seen the sign. There's a little tiny sign out front that's all covered in butterfly images of butterflies, and it says, you know, all are welcome. And she came in, and she was a big woman, young. I would guess maybe 18, 19, 20. And she had on a pair of shorts that were probably 4 sizes too small for her. They looked more like underwear. And a t-shirt that was ripped and hung so low that, I mean, it really didn't, it was so stretched and out of shape that it really didn't cover her body. It's just hanging on her. And she came in and she said, "Can I get something to eat?" And Esther went over to her and hugged her and told her what was available to her. And she looked down and she noticed that the woman's feet were all bloody, dried blood, caked. And remember, they just walk. They just walk up and down the street. They're never off their feet for very long. And she had a pair of slides on, you know, like gym, like you'd wear it to the gym, like you just slide your foot in, like sandals. And her feet were so swollen that the slides were too small for her, and her feet were swollen over them. And Esther is a nurse. And Esther said, "Honey, you've got to let me take care of your feet." And so the woman sat down, and the only thing she said without being asked, because nobody asks questions, she sat down in the chair and she looked at Esther and she said, "I just relapsed. I was doing so good." And that's really all she said. And she sits in the chair and Esther pulls on a pair of latex gloves and gets a plastic pan, like a hospital pan, fills it with warm water. And she sits down and she takes off the woman's shoes. And as she does so, she's explaining how Jesus washed the feet of the disciples. And she takes the woman's feet and she puts them in this pan of water that just instantly swirls with blood and dirt. It's just instantly brown. And you could see how painful it was. Imagine that, the peroxide and what was in that water seeping into her open blisters, her wounds on her feet. She was hugging herself and she's rocking back and forth and rocking back and forth. And she just kept kind of whimpering. She would just whimper. But she couldn't cry. And there were no tears. And that just struck me so. Because there's a couple things. Maybe she was so dehydrated she didn't have any tears. Or maybe her pain has been so great her whole life she's got nothing left in her to cry. And I was just, it was a moment that I'll never forget. And there's all this action happening all around. Women, you know, eating and talking and trying on clothes. And it was just like this vacuum had just swooped down. And it was just Esther and this woman. And everything else just sort of faded away. Because for 15 minutes, somebody loved her. They weren't asking her any questions. They just said, "Let me take care of you." And Esther said, "Do you need some clothes?" And she said, "I do." And so they found her an outfit because she couldn't really walk. So she sat in the chair and they found her an outfit. And I went over, actually, everyone was so busy. So I went over and dug out some socks and some underwear for her from the pile of new underwear and socks. And we got her, she had a little tiny bag she was carrying that was stuffed with just stuff. So Esther got her a bigger bag. And then Esther said, you came in because you were hungry. Do you want some food? And she said, "Can I just take it with me?" And Esther said, "Sure, we'll make you a to-go plate." But, and in the house, in the drop-in center, and I loved this, it's a house on Sullivan. So there's a full kitchen. And the women who eat there have to eat in the kitchen and they have to eat around the table. That's really the only rule, because that's what we do, right? We gather at our table in life, and they want these women to gather at this table and either eat in silence or chat about things that the rest of us talk about. And they did. They'd ask about their kids. Had they seen their kids lately? Those kinds of things. And so the woman wanted a to-go plate, and Esther fixed it for her. And Esther walked her out the back door, and I went with them. And Esther has this van full of clothes and shoes and things so that if she sees somebody on the street, she can pull up to him and say, "Here, what do you need?" So Esther found her a pair of tennis shoes. They would be better than the slides she was wearing. And I'm crying as I'm watching it, and I'm trying to talk to her, and not for the story, just as a human. I just wanted to talk to her as a human. and try to find out a little bit more about her. Like, do you have anybody we can call, or, you know, anybody who can help you? And she wasn't interested in really, I don't know if she was aware enough. She was just exhausted. The exhaustion was just, had consumed her. She puts on the shoes. She sits on the bumper of Esther's van and she puts on the tennis shoes. And she gets up and she just walks on down the alley. And I watched her as far as I could see her. And she just, and it was night, it was dark. So I watched her and she just, and that was it. She just slipped into the night. And I just stood there thinking, I wonder what's going to happen next. And the women who run the drop-in center are just angels. And when I got ready to leave, they said, after your story runs, have we converted you? Do you want to be a volunteer? You're going to come back, right? And I said, I couldn't do this. Because I would go home feeling like I didn't save them. You gave them comfort and love for a couple of hours, and then they walked back out into the night. But that's not how the women who run the drop-in center see it. They see it like those 2 hours are worth it. It gave them 2 hours of comfort and solace. And it was just an extraordinary moment for me as a reporter.
Most have accepted that that's the way life is. They believe that they are part of the forgotten in our city, that the people in power want to focus more. I heard this a lot, that we're never going to be the Short North. We're never going to be German Village. We're not even going to be Marion Village. That's why many refer to themselves still as living in the bottoms. And in terms of the women, I had very few that said to me, go away, or I don't want to talk to you. In that moment, when they found out that I wasn't a John and I wasn't looking for sex act, they were shocked and I think comforted that somebody was interested in something rather than abusing or using them. But in terms of the residents who, and we dedicate one of the days of the series to this, who are committed to staying, many have not. Holly referenced earlier the numbers that show that this is the area that is plagued worse by, or the most by, the ills of homelessness and poverty. And the numbers tell us that there's more vacant homes on Sullivan than anywhere in our city. And a lot of that is because that the people over the last several decades have moved away. And many of those homes have rotted away. They've become drug houses or places temporarily where some of the women stay or the homeless stay. And the people that have decided to stay are surrounded by this. We interviewed several folks who have chosen to stay. They talk about how it wasn't always like this. I think they have fond memories of 20, 30 years ago when their kids were able to walk down the street to school and they didn't have to worry as much. And again, some of these folks do take pride. There's a couple, they're the Stinsons that are in our series. And their house stands out so much. And they take such pride. That house would fit in well somewhere in Clintonville or another part of our city. They take great pride. It's amazing how folks are sitting on the porch and they're just watching. They're waiting for the next car to pull up or the next woman to walk by. It just boggled my mind of like, what could they be sitting on the porch, you know, waiting to see day after day after day that they haven't already seen? But again, we go back to hopelessness. I think that, you know, in the back of their minds, maybe they're praying for change, but they don't really think it ever really is.
I want to piggyback on that because I said earlier, I talked about just the complete lack of hope. And that's unfair, I think. As I've listened, as we've talked, and I think about it, and I think what Mike said is that's more accurate and that is right. They have accepted what life is like on Sullivan Avenue. But I think there is hope. Maybe someday somebody's going to pay attention. I think they think it's unlikely, but there's hope. Because, you know, the whole impetus behind this series. We had talked about what to do, as I said at the beginning, after the officer shot and killed Donna Dalton Castleberry. But I was covering the 10-year anniversary of Catch Court in Columbus, which is the court that tries to put those convicted of prostitution and victims of human trafficking on a better path. And I was writing about Catch Court, and I'd spent several days in the court. And a woman got up, and the judge introduced her as Sergeant Dana Hess of the Columbus Police Department. She was out of uniform, and she got up and she spoke to the women, and she stood, I can still see it, she stood with her arms open like Jesus on the cross. And she said, on behalf of the Columbus Division of Police, I apologize for what's been done to you. And the women were, some of the women were, there was just shock in the room. And she came to apologize for Andrew Mitchell and what he had done, because we now know that he's been accused of forcing the women to have sex with him out there, or he would arrest them. So if they wanted their freedom, they'd have to have sex with him. So she apologized to these women, and she wrote her number up on a board, and she said, if anyone hurts you out here, you call me and you tell me. If there's a police officer out here that's hurting you, let me know. And I came back to the office and I said, this is a big deal. And this is what we're going to do. And it was Mike's idea then to sort of profile Sullivan Avenue as if it were a character in a novel. And that's what we set out to do. But to the point of hope, I think there is hope for people like Judge Herbert of Catch Court and Sergeant Hess and Sergeant Brophy, who's on the ground out there every day on Sullivan. They want things to change, but they recognize it's going to take the whole city. It's going to take an effort like it took to reform Wineland Park up north into what it is today. So I think the area commissions in those two neighborhoods in Franklinton and the Hilltop, the volunteers and the advocates out there, there's so much love and so many good-hearted people who want to help get those in active addiction out of it and get those who live on the streets someplace to stay. But it's just not, there's not a coalition, there's no coalescence of an effort and a promise from the city to say, let's get this done. Build the services where people are, put them where people are. We need shelters out there and more drop-in centers and more places where those in active addiction can go for help if they have one moment that they want it. Because if they want it and there's nowhere to go, an hour later it's gone and they're using it again. So I think there is hope, but it's overwhelmed by the skepticism that anything will ever change.
To read the entire series, visit dispatch.com/Sullivan. And you can find Holly and Mike on Twitter at Holly Zachariah and at Mike Wagner 48. Or email them at hzachariah@dispatch.com and mwagner@dispatch.com. We also want to acknowledge Dispatch reporters Bethany Bruner, Doug Caruso, Jim Woods, and Patrick Cooley, who contributed to this series.